Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Robert Kuttner. He is an economist. He is the founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and the author of the new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be with you.
You use a term in your book that's not commonly heard, and that is managed capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of management has our economy had since the Great Depression, and how has it been dismantled in the movement that is called deregulation?
Well, that's the right question. Some economics textbooks tell you that supply and demand is really everything you need to know about an economy, and if the government just leaves the economy alone, everything will come out fine. And of course, we've learned in the last 100 years or so that that's just not the case, that there are some things that free markets don't provide, like education or health care. So you have to have government step in and give people benefits that the market's not going to give them, but that are necessary both for a decent society and for a reliable economy. There are also consumer protections that are necessary, because otherwise industry is going to use its disproportionate power to foist unsafe products or unsafe workplaces on innocent consumers who just don't have the ability to match the resources of corporations. And then, most importantly, financial markets have this unfortunate habit of going haywire every once in a while because of speculation. So since the Great Depression, the United States has had what some people call a mixed economy, what other people call a managed form of capitalism, where the economy is basically a capitalist economy, but some goods are provided socially, and consumer protections offset the power of corporations to do whatever they please. Environmentalism has been another vivid example of why you can't just let the private sector do whatever it wants to. And the problem is that since the 70s, the gains that were made during the 30s and 40s, 50s, 60s that made for a more balanced economy of shared prosperity have been reversed. And they've been reversed because the business regained a lot of the power that it lost after it was disgraced by the crash of 1929. And so instead of a balanced form of capitalism or a managed form of capitalism, we've had a widening degree of inequality, we've had a widening degree of insecurity, and now on top of it, we have a financial meltdown.
So let's talk about some of those things. First of all, who benefits and who loses in the process of deregulation, and what really specifically was being regulated that was now deregulated?
Well, lots of things. Consumer protections were much stronger 20 or 30 years ago. Environmental protections were much more effective. The right to join a union was enforced. It's no longer enforced. People who try to join unions or organize unions run the risk of being fired. And I think, most importantly, banks, which are really part of the nation's monetary system, were regulated. They were carefully examined. They were carefully supervised. They were not permitted to speculate. And a lot of those regulations were either torn up or not enforced. So the consequence of that is things like the collapse of subprime mortgages, where loans that never should have been made were made to people who had no capacity to pay the loans back at above-market interest rates, so that a lot of middlemen could get very rich. And the spillover effect on the wider economy is very serious. So who did deregulation benefit? Well, it benefited a lot of insiders, a lot of middlemen, and a lot of very wealthy people, or people who hoped to become wealthy. Who did it harm? It harmed ordinary consumers and ordinary families.
How do you understand the health of an economy? How do you actually measure it? There's a lot of what seems like psychology and fear and, you know, confidence and lack of confidence and so on. But when you look at the real measures, how do you measure it?
Well, there are basically a couple of tried and true ways to measure it. One is to look at gross domestic product, which is the sum total of all the goods and services in the economy, and see what rate of growth the economy is enjoying. And typically, the economy grows at a rate of between 2 and 4%. But that only tells you how the economy is doing on average. You also have to look at who's benefiting. And there was a very interesting turning point that occurred in the early 1970s. Between World War II and the early 70s, the economy grew at about 4% a year, which is pretty good, and it also became more equal. The bottom half actually gained income at a higher rate than the top half. It became more equal in lots of different ways. Ordinary working people got raises. Women got opportunities that they never had before. African Americans got opportunities that they never had before. And so the whole society became a less unequal place. The other, I guess, the third way I would measure the economy, and this is kind of the most intangible, is how are we doing with the natural environment? Are we leaving the earth a better place than we found it, or a worse place? And the traditional measures, such as gross domestic product or the annual growth rate, don't do very well at assessing how we're doing with the environment, because pollutants are counted as part of GDP. So if you produce more sulfur dioxide, you've added something to GDP, even though people would say that's not a good.
Now, hang on.
That's a bad.
It's if you produce cars that adds to GDP, not sulfur dioxide itself.
No. Fair point. On the other hand, the waste products that are dumped into a stream or goods that turn out to be poisoned are all counted as part of GDP. The gross measure of GDP doesn't differentiate between products that are safe and products that are hazardous. If you run a workplace that is causing workers there to come down with an occupational disease, not only is that production counted as part of GDP, but the cost of treating the disease is counted as part of GDP.
Right.
So my only point is you have to come up with better measures. Otherwise, you could be pillaging the environment and growing at the rate of 10% a year, which is, in fact, what the Chinese are doing. And by conventional measures, that would be seen as a great record.
How important is borrowing or credit to the health of an economy? I was wondering, I mean, when we look at the subprime mortgage situation, if everybody lived within their means and didn't borrow, what would this mean for the economy?
Oh, I think credit's terribly important. You can't expect an economy to live without credit. Businesses borrow money in order to finance purchases of new plant and equipment and in order to expand. Consumers borrow money in order to buy a house. Not too many people can afford to buy a house just out of their savings or out of their income. And if it's used responsibly, credit can be a very good thing. The government also borrows money. And as long as the debt is not growing faster than the economy, the national debt is actually a useful thing to have because it finances things that the economy needs. It's when debt gets out of control or debt is used for consumption as a substitute for income. People's paychecks don't keep up with inflation, but they have certain fixed costs, so they depend on credit cards or they depend on home equity loans. Or you have predatory lenders persuading people to take out very high interest loans so that the lender can make more money, then debt becomes a problem. So you really have to get down to cases. It depends on what the debt's used for. It depends on the ratio of how much debt you've taken on to how much debt you can really afford to pay back.
What do you mean when you say the national debt is a good thing and it finances the things we need? I thought the national debt was really a debt. In other words, we not only pay debt, but we pay interest on that.
Well, again, it's a matter of degree. I mean, we've had a national debt in this country since Alexander Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury back in 1800, and actually 1896, I think. I'm sorry, 1797, I think it was. And Hamilton made the case that the federal government needed to absorb the debts that had been incurred during the Revolutionary War and also needed to go into debt to build things that the country needed, like roads, which would help the economy grow. And we also incurred debts to fight World War One, World War Two. I think within limits, if you are using the proceeds of debt to invest in things that the economy needs, like research and development or public infrastructure, you're increasing the economy's ability to pay back that debt the same way that it may make sense to go into debt to be able to afford college tuition. Now, if you're just incurring debt to go on a spending spree, that's going to catch up with you. That's not smart. But the issue is, what's the debt being used for, and is the debt manageable relative to the size of the total gross domestic product? Most economists would say that if the debt is about half of 1 year's GDP, that's reasonable. That's something that the economy can handle.
Now, under Clinton, we actually got rid of our debt. Was that
no? We got rid of our deficit. Let's. This is very important, and it's often confused. The national debt is the total money that the government has borrowed that the government owes people who hold its bonds. The deficit is how much the government runs in the red or borrows in any given year. And before Clinton was president, the two previous presidents, Bush 1 and Reagan, had been running huge deficits. So every time you have a budget deficit of, say, $300 billion, you're adding $300 billion to the national debt. What Clinton did was he balanced the budget so that in the year 1999, in the year 2000, the budget was in surplus, and rather than adding to the debt, we actually paid down some debt. But we didn't get rid of the national debt. I mean, the debt is still several trillion dollars.
So what do we have now in 2008 in terms of debt and in terms of deficit?
Well, we have a deficit that's, last time I looked, it was around 3% of GDP. That's too high. It probably should be 2% or less. But even more troubling is the reason why we have the deficit. We are not using that deficit to spend money on things that help the economy grow. The big reason for the deficit is twofold. One, we are running a deficit in order to finance the Iraq War, which a lot of people feel was an unnecessary war. And the second reason for the debt is that President Bush cut taxes on very wealthy people and blew a big hole in the federal government's ability to raise revenues. Now, if you had the same deficit, but you were using the money on research and development or to make college affordable or to rebuild public infrastructure or to make the country energy efficient and get rid of our dependence on dirty fuels that we have to import, I would say that we could live with a deficit of 3% of GDP because we were using the money productively. And the national debt, the last time I looked, has gone back to something like 50% of GDP. That's a lot of money, and it's reaching a tipping point where it's dangerously large.
We're talking to economist Robert Kuttner. His book is called The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Let's talk about hedge funds for a moment, because these seem to be playing a role in our economy. What are they, and what role do they play in the big picture?
Well, in 1940, Congress passed a law requiring mutual funds to disclose what they own, who runs them, and subjected mutual funds to all kinds of rules so that consumers who invested money in mutual funds would be protected. They put a little loophole in the law. They said if you have a private fund that's just for very rich people, you don't have to disclose anything. And that loophole became the basis for hedge funds. Now, once upon a time, there were funds that hedged their bets in various ways. And so hedge fund, the name of hedge fund, attached to these exotic funds for very wealthy investors. But a hedge fund today can describe a fund that has any number of strategies. It doesn't describe the strategy. It simply describes the fact that the fund is essentially unregulated. And some hedge funds use highly technical strategies to try and outguess currency markets. And other hedge funds use a very exotic financial instruments called derivatives to try and make bets on how to make a great deal of money on a very small investment by borrowing most of what's invested. And every once in a while, one of them blows up spectacularly. There was one, long-term capital management was called it, that blew up in 1997 because its entire financial strategy proved wrong, and it lost everything almost overnight. And the hedge fund had borrowed so much money from so many banks that the Federal Reserve had to come to its rescue. Otherwise, the banks, the biggest banks in the country, would have gotten in trouble. Nobody quite realized how much money this one hedge fund had borrowed from all these banks because nobody really knew what it was doing, because this hedge fund, like 9,000 other hedge funds, was exempt from financial regulation. So until the crisis struck, the regulators had no idea of how much exposure the banks had to this hedge fund. And now there are 9,000 of these. It's a kind of a hydra-headed monster. We haven't seen a hedge fund blow up in this latest crisis, but I'm sure we will. And it's an example of the risks that are taken when you have huge amounts of money gambled, really, without any regulatory scrutiny. And I think the other point about hedge funds is it's not clear that what hedge funds do adds anything to economic efficiency, because it's people making bets on financial securities rather than investing in the real economy.
And that's something that I think is very hard to understand, the sort of meta levels. One can understand production and consumption, but understanding these other things, I mean, it leads me to the question of how is the time we're living in now like 1929, and how is it different?
Well, there are some similarities in the following sense. If you look at the abuses of the 20s that ultimately caused the Great Crash, they were very, very complicated, but they boiled down to three things. There was too much speculation with borrowed money. There were too many insiders with conflicts of interest. And there was lack of disclosure so that people really didn't know what they were investing in. If you look at what happened with Enron in the 90s or what happened with subprime in this decade, it's exactly the same three abuses. Now, the difference between now and the 30s is that the Federal Reserve is much more sophisticated at preventing a recession from becoming a depression. And the government plays a bigger role so that we have unemployment compensation, we have Social Security, we have government just spending a larger percentage of GDP, which means that when the private part of the economy goes into a recession, people still get their Social Security checks. People still get their unemployment comp if they're unemployed. And if you lose money in a federally insured bank, the FDIC pays you back. These are known as automatic stabilizers. We didn't have those in the 20s. And so I think the financial crisis that we're in is going to be very serious. It's going to hurt a lot of people. It's not going to be another Great Depression. But I think it was needless. If we had not thrown away the rule book and allowed these practices in financial markets to happen, we would not be having this financial crisis today.
What is the political dimension of this? In other words, who pushed the people who make the laws and regulations to go in this direction, and why were they so successful?
Big part of the story is campaign money. Politics has become more and more expensive, and unfortunately, both political parties get a lot of campaign finance help from Wall Street. I think part of the Democratic Party is still the old Democratic Party of my youth and the Democratic Party of Roosevelt, which sticks up for the average working person. But another big part of the Democratic Party is pretty much in bed with Wall Street. And I think both parties colluded in the deregulation of financial markets. Republicans worse than Democrats, but a lot of Democrats have nothing to be terribly proud of. And I think the tragedy here is that the average person really would prefer an economy where it's not a matter of big government or small government. It's a matter of whether government is on your side. It's a matter of whether you have a tolerable degree of economic opportunity and economic security so that you don't lose your health coverage when you lose your job, or you don't lose your health coverage because somebody discovers that you have a pre-existing condition, or you don't lose your pension because Enron gets away with stealing it. And that requires a proactive role for government. It requires a government that's not captured by the big guys. And the subtitle of my book, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity, suggests the real reason why I wrote this book, which is to suggest that a different politics is possible, and that if leaders put it forward, I think voters would appreciate it.
If the current political policies put a lot of wealth in the hands of a tiny percentage of people, why is it that the vast majority of citizens can't elect leaders who will carry out what's in their best interest economically?
Well, I think let's divide that question. It's a complicated question. You know, if the government is not seen as delivering very much, then people say, what the heck, I'll just vote for the guy who's going to promise me a tax cut. And there are many things that working-age Americans would value if government delivered it, like health insurance that could never be taken away. Remember that? That was Bill Clinton's slogan in the 1992 campaign. Or secure retirement coverage, or things like paid parental leave, or high-quality child care. But these things are not being provided. And I think a lot of citizens are skeptical about whether we're ever going to get our politics back. And so people just throw up their hands. And at least if you get a tax cut, that's real money that you can spend at the store. We've gotten so far away from government that really helps ordinary people as economic beings that a lot of citizens are skeptical about whether we're ever going to get it back. The only part that still really works is the part that serves elderly people, Social Security and Medicare. They're very valued by older Americans. They make a tremendous difference in the ability of older Americans not to have to suffer poverty in old age. And I think we need the expansion of those kinds of opportunities and protections to working-age people. I think if we did, we'd have a much fairer, more balanced form of capitalism.
What does it mean for the economy that there have been so many jobs, so many productive jobs sent overseas? And what is the reality of this concept, this so-called service economy?
Well, you know, it's funny. 30 years ago when I first started studying this stuff, people said that the reason that we were suffering widening of income inequality was that we were losing manufacturing jobs, and everybody knows that manufacturing jobs pay well, and service jobs, you know, have a few high-income jobs at one end, rocket scientists and brain surgeons, and a lot of low-paid jobs at the other end, fast food workers and grocery clerks and so forth. Well, it turns out that the reason that manufacturing paid decently had very little to do with manufacturing itself, and everything to do with the labor movement. The reason that an American auto worker made 20 or 25 bucks an hour was not anything inherent in the work. It was the United Auto Workers fighting for good wages, and we know that because when that job moves to Mexico, it makes a buck and a half an hour, and when it moves to China, it makes 15 cents an hour. It's not the work. It's the social contract that exists or doesn't exist. So what happens when we shift to a service economy? There was a famous article by a Nobel Prize-winning economist named Leontief, written about 25 years ago, in which he proposed the following experiment. He said, what if the economy became so automated and so productive that there was only one human production worker, and her job was to flip the switch, and machines made all the physical goods? What would everybody do for a living? And how would we divide up the benefits of all of that production? My point is, and this was Leontief's point as well, that service work can be good jobs or it can be bad jobs, depending on how we structure it. So, for example, somebody who works with three-year-olds in a preschool can be a minimum wage worker with no training in a job that has very high turnover, or it can be somebody with a master's degree who makes $50,000 a year. And which sort of person that is who works with young children is a social choice. We can either have a progressive tax system and have people who are very wealthy pay decent taxes and use the proceeds from those taxes to have high-quality pre-kindergarten and child care, or we can say, no, we're just going to let that guy keep the money. It's his money, and if you can't afford good child care for your kid, that's too bad. Now, I prefer the kind of economy where people pay taxes based on ability to pay, and we use the revenue from those taxes to produce good service sector jobs, which in turn help produce healthier children. And other people would say, let the zillionaire keep his money. That's a political choice, and that's what politics is all about, what kind of society we want to have. So I think if we're going to have a service sector that pays decent wages and that creates jobs that are attractive jobs, that in turn provide services that can make the economy healthier and more productive, we need government to play a constructive role.
If jobs are moving overseas, but the American companies are still making money, paying the workers a lower wage overseas, the money that they make and the extra money they make needs to be redistributed in our economy in order for there to be any benefit at all to the service
sector. And also, if they are made to pay people overseas, who are human beings also, higher wages, and afford them rights, then they're not going to be quite so quick to move overseas, and there'll be a more equitable distribution of the jobs. So I think it's a matter of extending some of the protections that we fought for in the United States to workers all over the world, and it's also a matter of restoring taxation on American companies so that the people who make this windfall profit by paying workers in the third world such a low wage redistribute some of that money to Americans.
We're talking to Robert Kuttner. Let's talk about free trade. What is it? What's free about it? What is its effect on the U.S. economy?
Well, again, here you have to go back to theory versus reality. The theory says that if you have no barriers to trade between different nations, that everybody will gain. The reality is that different countries play by different rules. So if you produce in the United States, even though enforcement of health, safety, environment, and labor laws has been dramatically weakened in certain ways in recent years, you still have to pay minimum wage. There's a limit to how much pollution you can dump into the air and the water. There's a limit to how unsafe the workplace can be. Whereas if you move to China, there are no labor rights, hardly any environmental laws, and no rights at all when you think about it. Very low wages, no occupational health and safety, and a lot of poison gets spewed into the atmosphere. Now, that's not free trade. That's a country with one set of rules trading with a country with a very different set of rules. And what's interesting is that American industry fights fiercely so that intellectual property rights are protected in trade. But the other kind of rights that we have fought for the past 100 years, citizenship rights, worker rights, health, safety, and environmental protections for consumers, those rights just disappear when these products are traded internationally. So it seems to me that the whole concept of free trade exists in an economic textbook, but it doesn't exist in reality. And we need to base our policies on the third on the real world, not on some abstract algebra.
Now, has the U.S. ever had, or do we have now, the kind of protectionism that we want other countries not to use?
Well, funny thing is, until World War I, the United States was one of the most protectionist countries. And we used exactly the same arguments that countries like China are using today. If we had had no tariffs, we never would have gotten a foothold in a lot of industries because Britain was the leader. Britain could make the stuff cheaper. And the Brits' argument was, well, why don't you just import all of the manufactured goods you need from us and sell us agricultural goods? And a number of Americans said, well, wait a minute. If we do that, you're going to be richer than we are forever. We want to learn how to be manufacturers as well. So we had tariffs for the first 120 years of the Republic's existence, and they did just what they were supposed to do. They helped us acquire competitiveness in industries, and we were not the only country to do that. France did it, Germany did it, Japan did it, Korea did it, Brazil did it, China did it. Any country that's trying to catch up with a leader goes through a period when it protects its own industries. This is often referred to by economists as the infant industry argument. And a lot of countries, Japan and Korea being the two examples, even when they are mature, advanced countries, continue to protect their own industries and to discourage imports. So the real question is, how do different countries that have very different rules, very different social systems, trade with each other without one taking advantage of the other?
What is the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on international trade, on so-called free trade? And why are some countries, for example, in Latin America, starting to be skeptical about working with them?
Well, there was a period in the 80s and the 90s where the IMF and the World Bank had a kind of a one-size-fits-all philosophy, and it was a very conservative philosophy that just happened to be good for American banks and American businesses and not so good for these countries. And the idea was you should be scrupulously respectful of property rights. You should not spend much money on social needs. You should have low taxes on business, and you should have a balanced budget. And some countries said, well, wait a minute, we don't like that recipe. We want more social investment. We want to be able to tax business that's making money in our country. And the IMF would put pressure on them to adopt the kind of Reagan-Thatcher model of how economies were supposed to operate. And there was a rebellion against this one-size-fits-all brand of economics, and the IMF today is a much smaller player than it used to be because a lot of countries stopped doing business with it. The World Bank is a different sort of operation. World Bank is really intended to make loans, make investments to countries, and I think the World Bank has changed its position to some extent and is playing more of a constructive role than it did.
What do you think would be the best kind of, getting back to the question that we started with, of managed capitalism, what do you think is the most important kind of regulation that would be effective for our national economy, and what kind of crisis are we really facing if we don't do this?
Well, we're facing the most serious financial crisis since the Great Depression, because all of this speculation has left banks in a weakened condition. It's taken billions and billions and billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, really. Last time I looked, the total was $8.8 trillion out of the value of people's homes because of the speculation in subprime mortgages. So I think restoring financial regulation is probably more important than anything else. But I also think there are things that need to be paid for socially, like health insurance, that would produce a more efficient system of health care as well as a more equitable system of health care. Why should your health insurance be related to where you happen to work? It makes absolutely no sense. It makes even less sense in an era when people change jobs and even change careers frequently. So I think we need more balance between private wealth and social investment. We need both a better form of consumer protection through regulation and more social investment so that people have a greater degree of security and opportunity.
Now, this is something that every Democratic candidate, to a greater or lesser extent, has campaigned for, and it's something that the vast majority of Americans, when they're polled, seem to want. What is going on politically that the liberal or Democratic message isn't speaking to the people, or they're not voting for it?
Well, I think for starters, when you look at the fine print, a lot of Democrats are so intimidated by their donors that they're not for real. I think another problem is that the idea that balancing the budget is more important than anything else has become an article of conventional wisdom that has discouraged Democratic candidates, liberal Republican candidates, from proposing policies that would actually make a difference in people's lives, so that you have small token programs that really aren't going to transform the situation of the American middle class. And then, of course, you have the fact that we've had Republican presidents for 20 out of the last 28 years, meaning that when you do get the occasional liberal program, it gets vetoed. A good example being the Children's Health Insurance Program, which Bush, I think, has vetoed two or three times. So it kind of makes it hard for Democrats to work up the nerve to propose things that were bold. I was just in a conversation this morning about this, and you know, with a recession looming, there's talk of a so-called stimulus package, and we have a $14 trillion economy, and the Democrats are talking about a stimulus package, meaning spending, government spending during a recession, on things like a one-time cut in the payroll tax, or a one-time increase in unemployment insurance, or aid to state and local governments so that state and local governments don't have to cut back services. And they're talking about $100 billion. Seems like a lot of money. It's about a little more than half of 1% of GDP. Now, in a recession, the rate of GDP growth is going to go down by a lot more than half of 1%. And so my concern is that because of the constraints on what they think can be signed by President Bush, Democrats are going to shoot themselves in the foot from the start by proposing something that they themselves know is too feeble to get the job done. And then when this stimulus package passes Congress and it doesn't do much, they're going to share the blame for failing to get the country out of a recession. So I think the fact that we've had the last two Democratic presidents be middle-of-the-road presidents, not real progressives, Carter and Clinton, the fact that we've had Republican presidents in charge most of the time, the fact that Wall Street has so much influence, means that the whole political spectrum has shifted to the right. There's been a turning away from the use of government to balance the power, both politically and economically, of private business. And it's been a long time since younger voters have experienced government making a constructive difference in their lives. And so that reinforces the turning away from social remedies.
You said a moment ago that candidates were so intimidated by their donors that they're not for real. How does this apply to, for example, Hillary Clinton, if it does?
Well, I just looked this up. Hillary Clinton raised 63% of her total campaign finance in the form of donations of $2,300, which is the ceiling on how much you can give in a primary. So she's raised a disproportionate amount of money from big donors rather than small donors. She's got hedge fund operators and other Wall Street players raising a huge amount of money for her. Now, when you're relying on those kinds of people to fund your campaign, are you going to be on the barricades demanding re-regulation of financial markets? No, you're not. You're going to be very circumspect and very cautious. There was an effort by some Democrats to require people who make these windfall gains from running hedge funds to pay taxes at the ordinary rate, the same rate that their secretaries pay. Right now, the law is such that hedge funds' bonuses only pay tax at a rate of 15%.
Mm-hmm.
That's less of an income tax rate than you or I pay. And yet, because so many Democrats are in hock to so many big donors, the effort to pay for children's health insurance, listen to this, by raising the taxes on billionaires was stopped dead in its tracks. Partly because I think Democrats are so intimidated about being tarred as the party that raises any taxes, even taxes on billionaires, and partly because these billionaires are the people who are funding so many of these campaigns. So it really makes it harder for the Democrats to be the party that they once were and still could be, the party of the average working person.
Well, I mean, Barack Obama, in contrast to Hillary Clinton, has raised huge amounts of money from $25 increments.
Yeah, but I looked this up. He's also raised a ton of money in big increments. I mean, Obama, who I like, I think is trying to have it both ways. He's very idealistic. He's very inspiring. On the other hand, if you look at the details of his program, it's pretty cautious.
If somebody like Obama or some other Democrat managed to get elected and were to actually go forward in trying to do things like raise taxes on billionaires, what kind of pushback do you expect, and what kind of power do they have to really do a pushback?
Well, they have a lot of power. I mean, I think it's two things. I think Democrats, because they listen to public opinion pollsters, are very gun-shy about raising taxes on anybody right now, but at least can I stop for a second? I'm hearing a lot of static on the line. Are you hearing it?
Yeah, I don't know where it is. Now it's gone.
Well, I think all right, let's try it again.
Just go ahead.
I think there are two reasons. One is that Democrats, because they fear a backlash against the idea that they're the party of tax and spend, are reluctant to raise taxes on anybody, even people who can well afford to pay for them. But I think Democrats do get a lot of pushback from their donors whenever they talk about raising taxes on wealthy people.
We're talking to Robert Kuttner, author of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Robert Kuttner, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we're going to hear a song now, which is over 20 years old, but still perhaps somewhat relevant to our theme today. Here's Arlo Guthrie.
Oh, the price of gold is rising out of sight, and the dollar is in sorry shape tonight. What the dollar used to get us now won't buy a head of lettuce. No, the economic forecast didn't write. But amidst the clouds, I spot a shining ray. I can even glimpse a new and better way. And I've devised a plan of action, worked it down to the last fraction, and I'm going into action here today. I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what they did. Iacocca will be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am heading for that great receiving line. So when they hand a million grand out, I'll be standing with my hand out. Yes, sir, when my creditors are screaming for their dough, I'll be proud to tell them all where they can go. They won't have to scream and holler. They'll be paid to the last dollar, where the endless streams of money seem to flow. I'll be glad to tell them all what they can do. It's a matter of a simple form or two. It's not just remuneration. It's a liberal education. Ain't you kinda glad that I'm in debt to you? 'Cause I'm changing my name to Chrysler. I'm going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what they did. I hope it will be perfectly acceptable to me. Grand out, I'll be standing with my hand out, yes, sir. first amphibians crawled out of the slime. I love that line a whole lot. Even if Tom didn't write the rest of the song, it'd be worth it just for that line. Let's just do it again for me. You can sing along too. It's when since the first amphibians crawled out of the slime of the slime. Goes like that. Since the first amphibians crawled out of the slime, we've been struggling in an unrelenting climb. We were hardly up and walking before money started talking, and it's sad that failure is an awful crime. Well, it's been that way for a millennium or two, but now it seems that there's a different point of view. If you're a corporate Titanic and your failure is gigantic, down in Congress there's a safety net for you. So I'm changing my name to Chrysler. I am going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what they did for my coca. Will be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am headed for that grid receiving.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Thank you.